From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. After the assassination of President Kennedy, his brother Robert publicly accepted the Warren Commission's conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. But Kennedy privately believed his brother was the victim of a conspiracy. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about that and more with David Talbot, author of Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. Talbot founded the online magazine Salon.com. Also, actor Kevin Costner. He's played a legendary minor league ball player, a cavalry lieutenant who comes to live among Sioux Indians, and the federal agent out to get Al Capone. Now he's a respected family man with a secret life as a serial killer in the new film Mr. Brooks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Few subjects in American history have been as relentlessly scrutinized as the Kennedy assassination. But a new book by my guest, journalist David Talbot, looks at the question of whether Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy in Dallas from a unique perspective, that of the president's brother, Robert Kennedy. Talbot says it's clear Bobby Kennedy never believed Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in Dallas, and Talbot's book argues his suspicions were well-founded. It focuses on the Kennedy brothers' partnership in the White House and contends they were constantly undermined and threatened by forces in the military, the CIA, the mafia, and the Cuban exile community. The administration was, Talbot argues, a government at war with itself. David Talbot worked for years as a writer and editor in several publications and is the founder of the online magazine Salon.com. His new book is Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. Well, David Talbot, welcome back to Fresh Air. You open this book with an account of Bobby Kennedy's movements and reaction in November 1963 to his brother's shooting in Dallas. Did Bobby Kennedy have an immediate belief or theory about who had killed President Kennedy?
Yes, literally, immediately. That afternoon, he happened to be at his home in Virginia at Hickory Hill, the old Civil War estate where he and his family lived. And it was J. Edgar Hoover, of all people, who phoned him that day, his arch enemy, the head of the FBI, to tell him that his brother had been shot, and then soon after that his brother had died. And Bobby immediately, we know, from the phone calls and conversations he's having that day from his home, immediately suspects that Lee Harvey Oswald is not the complete story. And he immediately is looking into the shadowy war against Castro that is being run by the CIA and has enlisted gangsters in its attempts to kill Castro as the source of the plot against his own brother.
Well, and of course, Bobby had made a lot of enemies in the underworld for many years by investigating the mob and the Teamsters Union. Did he do anything to investigate the crime, Bobby Kennedy?
He did. And this is the great, of course, drama of the story that I tell, because publicly what Bobby is saying, of course, is that he accepts the official version of Dallas, the Warren Report. But privately, it's a very different story. Privately, he's a man on fire to get to the bottom of the story from that afternoon on. And he's looking himself into various leads. He's using surrogates, former FBI agent named Walter Sheridan, who was his right-hand investigator, a number of people on his staff who he trusted, to pursue every lead. And literally, he goes from New Orleans to Chicago to Dallas to Mexico to Moscow, either himself or using these surrogates, these aides, to pursue every lead that he can.
You mentioned that he dispatched someone to Moscow. What was that all about?
Well, that's a remarkable story. This is a week after the assassination of President Kennedy. He goes to a close family friend named William Walton. Now, Walton is a very interesting character in his own right. He was a Time magazine war correspondent during World War II, knew the eldest Kennedy brother, Joe Kennedy, before his death in the war. He'd gotten to know Jack Kennedy as a young congressman and Jackie Kennedy in Georgetown before they moved into the White House. And he was used as a confidential emissary and a political operative by the Kennedy family for a number of years. He had been due to go to Moscow a week after the assassination as part of JFK's efforts towards détente with the Soviet Union. He was going to lead an artistic exchange mission to Moscow. He thought the mission would be canceled after Dallas, but Bobby and Jackie Kennedy both go to Walton and say, no, go ahead with this mission and take a confidential message from us, the Kennedy family, to the Soviet government. He does that, and he meets with a Soviet agent named Georgi Bolshakov, who both Jack and Bobby had come to trust while he was an agent in Washington. They used him as a back-channel courier to Khrushchev in the Kremlin. And Walton has dinner with Bolshakov in Moscow, and he tells him a remarkable thing. He says, we don't blame you, the Soviets, for the assassination, even though Oswald is being portrayed in the press at that point as a communist agent. We know that it was a domestic high-level political conspiracy that killed the president, and Bobby Kennedy intends to run for president at some point, and when he does, if he succeeds, he will resume the policies of President Kennedy's of détente towards the Soviet Union. Well, I find this a stunning, of course, story because this is the height of the Cold War. And at this point, it indicates that Bobby Kennedy and the family are placing more trust in the Soviet government than in their own government.
Publicly, he endorsed the findings of the Warren Commission that Oswald acted alone, right?
That's right.
And I was struck by one fascinating detail you discovered, that Kenny O'Donnell, who was the special assistant to President Kenny, who was actually played by Kevin Costner in the movie 13 Days, he was in the motorcade in Dallas and felt strongly that President Kennedy took shots from in front, from the grassy knoll, not from behind where Oswald was, sniper's perch was. But Bobby Kennedy instructed him to lie to the Warren Commission.
Well, that's what I suspect. It's a very revealing story. As you say, Kenny O'Donnell's riding 10 feet behind the president's limousine in Dallas with another White House aide named Dave Powers. These are part of Kennedy's so-called Irish mafia, very loyal aides. Now, both of these men, Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers, had been World War II veterans. They knew the sound of gunfire, and they distinctly heard gunfire, they later said, and they told the FBI this, and they told Bobby Kennedy this, both from the grassy knoll area as well as from behind, as you say, the Texas Book Depository. Well, of course, that immediately indicates there was a conspiracy if you have two sharpshooters. But Kenny O'Donnell, I think, was prepared to tell the truth to the Warren Commission, as Dave Powers was. But I do believe it was not just the FBI who told him that he didn't want to go there, which they did. But it was probably Bobby, because I think Kenny O'Donnell was so loyal to Bobby that he would have taken orders only from him. And at this point, Bobby Kennedy has determined he has no power, no official power, even though he's still attorney general, to pursue this crime. The new president, Lyndon Johnson, loathes him. The head of the FBI, which is taking the lead in the investigation into the assassination, J. Edgar Hoover, also has a poisonous relationship with Bobby Kennedy. His power to investigate the crime begins to evaporate from the moment his brother dies. He knows that he has to wait, bide his time, which is what he tells people. He tells his family that weekend in the White House, a very dramatic scene where he begins to confide in family members who are gathering for the funeral of the president. This is what's happened. It's a high-level plot. It involves elements of the government, but we can't do anything until we get back to the White House and we have the machinery of the federal government to investigate this.
Let me just go back to that. You're saying that Bobby Kennedy, you know for a fact that he told members of his family the weekend after the assassination that this was a conspiracy. How do we know that?
We know this from people who were in the White House that weekend, including Peter Lawford, who was the president's brother-in-law. Peter Lawford is dead. I interviewed a close friend of his who reported this to me. And we know from other people that Bobby is saying the same thing during that period.
Well, I want to talk about some of the events in the Kennedy administration that gave rise to the suspicions about the assassination. President Kennedy faced a huge test, a disaster early on, and that was the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. This was, of course, for those too young to recall, a CIA-backed invasion of Cuban exiles who were going to overthrow Castro, which quickly turned into a disaster when the invasion force was pinned down on a Cuban beach. And there was enormous pressure from within the Cuban community and the military on Kennedy to bring U.S. military forces into the conflict, in effect, to join in an invasion of the island. He resisted and refused. And, of course, the invasion force was taken captive and the whole thing was a big fiasco. What was the effect of Kennedy's reputation among the military and intelligence services? How was it affected by the Bay of Pigs disaster?
Well, I think it's at this point in the Kennedy administration, and it's quite early on. It's only a matter of a few months into the administration in April 1961. It's at this point when I believe the government cracked, that you have essentially a government at war with itself from that point on, because Kennedy's own national security apparatus now decides that Kennedy is weak and can't be trusted. They had thought, as you say, that he would have gone in and reinforced the beleaguered Cuban exiles pinned down on the beaches, that he would have brought massive U.S. military power to bear. And indeed, I believe they knew that the invasion itself, the initial invasion, would be a fiasco, and they thought they would be able to sandbag Kennedy into sending in the full might of the U.S. military. Kennedy came to that same conclusion himself, and he was enraged. He vowed to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds, while the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, the legendary spymaster, and others began muttering darkly among themselves and the military that Kennedy was in over his head. He couldn't be trusted. He wasn't the leader that America needed.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of these ranking officials in the military. You know, in 2007, it's a little hard to recall kind of the intensity of that Cold War period and the threat of, you know, nuclear war hanging over the nation. Were there military leaders who seriously wanted to provoke a new nuclear confrontation with the Soviets?
Yes, there were. And in particular, the head of the Air Force, General Curtis LeMay, a World War II hero. Robert McNamara, Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, had worked under him in Japan during the war. And Curtis LeMay did indeed feel that the country not only could but should launch a preemptive nuclear strike against the Soviet Union. The United States at that point had overwhelming nuclear superiority. And he felt that if you're going to fight a nuclear war with the Soviets, and he felt it was inevitable, that you should fight it sooner rather than later when the Soviets would begin to catch up with the United States. And in fact, he had this debate with Defense Secretary McNamara. He felt that you could win a nuclear war if you had more nuclear weapons than your enemy at the end of the Holocaust, whereas McNamara argued that you had to take into account the casualties and, of course, the devastation that would ensue.
You also write that a lot of the military structure, not just Curtis LeMay, but a lot of people in the military held really hardline anti-communist views and openly criticized the president as an appeaser. I mean, this is sort of shocking for those of us who are used to thinking of the military as being under civilian control. It was a different world then.
A very different world. The U.S. military was very politicized. There were political rallies, anti-communist rallies, held in a number of places throughout the country in which active duty military officers would participate. General Edwin Walker, who was a very respected military commander in West Germany at the time, distributed John Birch, you know, far-right material to his troops in the ranks. He advised them how to vote in American elections, and he considered all liberal democratic candidates socialists and treasonous. This man finally was forced out of the military and became an arch enemy of the Kennedys and campaigned against the Kennedys all around the country. But the mutinous atmosphere within the American military became so alarming to JFK himself that at one point he approaches a friend in Hollywood, John Frankenheimer, the director, and he urges him to make a movie version of the best-selling novel 7 Days in May, which, of course, was about an attempted military coup in Washington. He does this, I believe, to not only as a warning shot across his general's bow, but also to try and awaken the American people to the threat, the growing threat against democracy at that point.
Did Kennedy truly believe a military coup was possible?
I believe he was concerned about it. You know, it's remarkable when you see transcripts of conversations in the White House, and of course he had a taping system, so we have some of these conversations verbatim, and conversations he had with close friends, how often the subject of assassination or coup, the violent specter of the end of his own presidency, would come up in these conversations.
Give us an example of that.
Yeah. Well, one day he's sailing with an old friend, Red Fay, who he'd appointed Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And Fay has been reading 7 Days in May, the book, and brings it up and says, "Do you think something like that could ever happen here, Jack?" And JFK, instead of just dismissing it out of hand, says, "Well, you know, if there were a shock to the system, something like the Bay of Pigs, people in, you know, the military might begin to wonder about the president, particularly if the president's young and untested," which, of course, JFK was. "Then if there's another shock after that, and maybe possibly a third one, yes, there might be elements within the military," he tells his friend, "that would move against the White House at that point out of a sense of national duty." And I believe he felt, he was, of course, JFK had very finely tuned political radar. He picked up on these tremors within his own government. And I believe in conversations like this, he is expressing those concerns.
My guest is David Talbot. His new book is Brothers: The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is David Talbot. He is the founder of the online magazine Salon, and he has a new book, Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. So what you have is a situation where you have this hotbed of angry anti-Castro Cubans in South Florida who regard Kennedy as a traitor for not supporting them at the Bay of Pigs. You have CIA operatives, rogues who were doing things without the knowledge of the government, in league with the mafia, who have their own reasons to hate Kennedy. So you have three forces that are angry enough at President Kennedy to give rise to suspicion once President Kennedy is assassinated that they might have been behind it. And there are lots of fascinating connections we can't go into here among a lot of the players. But I have to ask you one thing. You know, mob historians who followed the mafia, one thing that they tell us is that they generally want to operate and make their money. And over the years, they've historically not killed cops or prosecutors. That was off limits. What makes us believe that they would actually order a hit on a president?
Well, let me just say, very emphatically, I don't believe the mafia were the ultimate intellectual architects behind this crime, behind the assassination of President Kennedy. And nor did I believe Bobby feel that way. He was looking more, as I say, at the CIA and elements of his own government. But I do believe the mafia played a role, and I do believe Bobby Kennedy thought that as well. You know, within 24 hours of Jack Ruby, the Dallas nightclub operator who shoots Lee Harvey Oswald down on national television, within 24 hours of that shocking crime, Bobby has investigators looking into who Jack Ruby is, and they report back to him immediately that he's not just a patriotic American who felt terrible about what had happened to the president and was shooting Oswald out of his sense of grief. This is a man who was basically a low-level mafia errand boy, and Bobby Kennedy knew this. Bobby Kennedy tells his press secretary years later, Frank Mankiewicz, when I saw the phone records of all the people Jack Ruby was calling before Dallas, before the assassination, it looked like my witness list for the Senate Rackets Committee. So Bobby's putting together how the mafia played a role in it, but my sense is that he believed it was a high-level political plot that had utilized the mafia in some way to carry out certain roles within the operation.
You know, most, if not all, of the players who would have firsthand information about the assassination are now dead. Is there fresh source material that's still hidden that might be mined for new clues about the assassination?
Yes, there is, and it began actually in the 1970s with the Church Committee investigation into the CIA and the House Select Committee on Assassinations later in the 70s. Many of the areas that Bobby Kennedy was looking into, again, were stirred up by these investigations, the CIA's war on Castro, the gangsters, militant exiles, and a number of the people who played a role in those investigations who came under suspicion. We could learn more about today. As a result of a bill that was passed in 1992 because of the Oliver Stone film, JFK, thousands of government documents were released. But the CIA continues to sit on many of these documents. And in fact, they're going to court this summer against a Washington Post reporter named Jeff Morley, who's played, I think, a heroic role in trying to get to the bottom of the case. And he's trying to get the agency to release records on some of these men, in particular a man named George Ioannidis, who we now know was tied to Lee Harvey Oswald in the early 60s before the assassination.
Ioannidis was a CIA man, right?
That's right. Ioannidis was the CIA official in charge of a Cuban student exile group that was tangling with Oswald and had some mysterious interaction with him. We know that another CIA official, David Phillips, before he died, intimated that he was one of the CIA's handlers for Lee Harvey Oswald. So It goes on and on. Howard Hunt, who recently died, the legendary Watergate burglar who was, again, part of the CIA's war on Castro, he revealed to his son, his eldest son, before he died, that he was asked to come to a meeting at a CIA safe house in Miami where the plot to kill the president was discussed. There's a lot of curious things about this, and there's no good reason for them to continue to sit on this. This is American history, and Americans have a right to their history. And I hope that they finally see that these documents should be released.
Well, David Talbot, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Journalist David Talbot founded the online magazine Salon.com. His new book is Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to music from the film The Untouchables, which starred Kevin Costner as the federal agent Elliot Ness. Coming up, Costner talks with us about his life, his acting, and the advice he got from Richard Burton when he was a nobody in Hollywood. Costner plays a family man who's also a serial killer in the new film, Mr. Brooks. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest Kevin Costner has been one of the most recognized faces in Hollywood for 20 years. Emerging as a leading man from films like No Way Out, The Untouchables, and Bull Durham, then directing and starring in Dances with Wolves, which won 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. Among his other films are Field of Dreams, JFK, Waterworld, 10 Cup, 13 Days, and The Upside of Anger. Costner's newest role is a dark one in the film Mr. Brooks. He plays Earl Brooks, a successful business owner and family man who has a secret life as a serial killer. The film is about his struggle with an addiction to the thrill of murder, and he frequently argues with his evil alter ego, Marshall, played by William Hurt. In this scene, Mr. Brooks is at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting where he doesn't reveal the nature of his addiction, and he's challenged by his dark side, Marshall.
Hi, my name's Earl, and I'm an addict. Anyone else?
If you were honest, you'd step up there and say, "Hi, I'm Earl. I killed two people last night. I really got off on it, but I need your help to be cured."
I'm different, Marshall. I won't argue that with you. But this is the only place that has ever helped me be normal, and I have been straight up until last night, for the past 2 years. I'm not going to kill again. And I am not going to quit coming here because it upsets you.
Well, Kevin Costner, welcome to Fresh Air. This new film you're in, Mr. Brooks, you know, I haven't seen all of your movies, but I can't remember you playing anybody as creepy as this.
Right.
Describe your character, Earl Brooks, and what appealed to you about this role.
Well, I have played characters that had some sinister sides in Perfect World and 3,000 Miles to Graceland, and one might argue that Wyatt Earp had some killer in him. But I think I know where you're going with this. As for describing my part, you know, why I wanted to do it, I actually don't go about it that way. I have to make sure I enjoy the script first. If I make the determination, I think, yeah, this has a playability, either a wide audience or a narrow one, but it must have an audience. And so when I read that, I was attracted first to how the screenplay read, all the parts included. And at that point, knowing that I thought this was a good movie or felt that it had a chance to be a classic, once I made that determination, and I had to figure out if there was a part in there that I thought that I could play. And Earl Brooks, I saw it. I understood the darkness. I also understood the empathy that might be evoked.
How did you figure out how to play a serial killer, and as you say, in this case, one who's a very empathetic character in parts of his life?
Yeah, it almost does a disservice to just start off with serial killer, because immediately you're just going to eliminate a certain part of the audience, probably including me, that says, "Gee, I just don't want to go see a movie about that. Sorry, I like you very much, but thanks, but no thanks." I don't like serial killer movies. I don't like finding myself in a room with blood on the walls or, you know, too much silence. I don't like scary movies. You know, I don't like the haunted house situations. They genuinely, I guess, scare me. Hate to admit that, since I play a lot of superheroes. But in terms of how I played it, I obviously had all the research at the tip of my fingers. Unfortunately, that's the condition of our society, that we have these people all around us now, and there's probably not a channel, not an hour in the day that you can't find some channel devoted to this horrific situation that we see played out almost daily and weekly.
One of the things that William Hurt said in the production notes was that interplay between you and he reminded him of mirror exercises. What does he mean?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think we both really loved is, you know, we've had these careers where now we're kind of known around the world and among our own colleagues. But I think sometimes it's so fun to look back at your journey and how, before anyone knew you, you know, you look fondly back at class and the exercises that you performed and how you, you know, mimic each other. And there's 100 games you play as an actor. And I think those that love acting the most love all the games. And William's talking about exercises that one does in mimicking each other and voice quality and kind of value for value acting, whether it's voice or a physical movement.
Oh, so you're not standing in front of a mirror, you're standing in front of another actor mimicking each other.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, you're and again, we're playing the same guy. It forced us to go into our bag of tricks.
I want to talk a little bit about your career. You grew up in California. From what I gather, a more or less normal existence, to the extent anybody has one. Played sports in high school. And what was the impulse that pushed you into performing, into acting?
Well, I really, I was born in Compton, lived for first 7-8 years, and then kind of moved around a lot. Went to 4 different high schools, but I really had a very normal childhood. I mean, I we weren't poor, but we weren't rich. It was only when I started seeing other people's backyard did I understand that we didn't have some of that stuff. But it was a childhood I wouldn't have traded. My upbringing was incredibly conservative, but has served me well. There are moments when I had to break out of that, and clearly the choice to become an actor was one of those. I needed to kind of get out of this maze of, what was a young man supposed to do? You're supposed to go to college, go to business, get a job and work, but something inherently in me was a voice that was coming out saying, man, you've got to find out really what you need to be about. I mean, and when I started to contemplate acting, because I always knew that I was performance oriented, the voice kept coming back. Yeah, you're just trying to postpone going out there into the real world and working. You know, I mean,
are we talking about college or after college or?
We're talking about during college, because I could tell that I was not equipped. I mean, I know what a good student is. I think probably one of my strengths, if I have any, is the recognition of who is kind of good at what they do. And I've never been intimidated by, knowing that I wasn't the guy. I was just encouraged knowing that the guy we needed in the right spot was in the room, or we better go find him because we don't have the right guy. And if I would assess myself, I was not an academic. And so I wasn't going to do well in school. And I could see that. And when I finally did stumble on to acting late at night one night in an accounting class where I was on the left side of the bell curve all the way to the end, I read about a play in the student newspaper, Rumpelstiltskin. And if I had to tell, it would have started wagging. I immediately started to get interested. Oh, I mean, tomorrow I can at 12 o'clock, I can go for an audition somewhere. I was clearly excited about 12 o'clock the next day and had no interest in what was happening at that very moment with a professor who was talking about accounting. But I was excited about that possibility, and I decided to chase that. And I obviously didn't get the audition, but from there I realized that they were providing classes one night a week. So I started to go one night a week, and one night a week turned into five nights a week, and I found it.
You know, there's a story. Sometimes these get mangled in the telling that an encounter with Richard Burton drove you to acting seriously. Is that right?
No, it did. It was a significant moment. Make no mistake. I think that's why it's lived a little bit in the consciousness of people. I did see him on a plane, and it was right around the time when I was saying. I was already taking these classes, and I was thinking, do I want to do this? And I desperately wanted to talk to him, and he had bought all the seats around him on the plane so that no one could talk to him. clearly everybody was watching him, and I was watching him. But at one moment, I just felt so compelled to go up to him, and his reaction could have been 100 different things to me, but it was incredibly generous. I think he was reading Gore Vidal's Lincoln at that moment, and he said, I will answer a question when I'm done reading or something like that. So I literally watched him for the next hour. And when he finally put the book down, I thought it was my moment. And then he leaned his seat back and went to sleep. And I thought, he's forgotten about me. And he took a little cat nap in about 15 minutes. He kind of woke up and looked back at me, and he kind of waved me up. And what we talked about was very, it was very sweet. And I asked him a couple questions, which... to this day, I wish that we could have circled back to each other to talk about. But it was significant, but how important, I don't know. I just saw him, and I thought, this is what I want to do.
Our guest is Kevin Costner. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, we're speaking with actor Kevin Costner. His new film is Mr. Brooks. Well, you got into acting, and I know that Lawrence Kasdan cast you for a role in The Big Chill, which is the answer to a trivia question. You're the guy at the beginning of the movie who's the cadaver who's being dressed for the funeral.
What's that worth now in Trivial Pursuits? Is it 50 points or what?
And then you're in Silverado, that great sweeping Western that he makes. And you had a string of really successful films early. I mean, No Way Out, where you played the Navy ensign, and The Untouchables.
Right.
And then kind of that enduring favorite, Bull Durham, you know. And this has taken you back 20 years now, I know, but those of us who still love and admire that movie just continue to quote it at ball games and all. Does it hold a special place in your heart, too?
Well, it does. I Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, those movies, for that matter, Love of the Game, those three particular movies are, I guess, represent my franchise. They're my sequels, I guess. But
Custer Baseball Collection. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess they are. You know, they're really standalone movies, and I've the architecture of my career has been the standalone movie for the most part, and those movies were absolutely individual, yet you know, circled the same subject.
Well, let's hear a clip from Bull Durham. This is you, of course, play Crash Davis, who is a veteran catcher with almost enough talent to make the big leagues, but basically has spent a career in the minor leagues. And in this film, he's at the Durham Bulls, and his job is to groom a young pitching talent, Nuke LaLouche, and you dispense advice. This is late in the film, where Nuke has finally gotten called up to the big leagues. You're kind of feeling down about your own career, but you sit and give him a last piece of advice. Let's listen.
Look, Nuke, these big league hitters are going to light you up like a pinball machine for a while, right? Don't worry about it. You be cocky and arrogant, even when you're getting beat. It's a secret. You got to play this game with fear and arrogance.
Fear and ignorance.
No. Fear and arrogance. All right, you hayseed, not ignorance.
No, I know. I just like seeing you get all worked up.
And that's Tim Robbins and my guest Kevin Costner from the classic Bull Durham. It's one of my favorite films, and you seem to just perfectly embody the swagger of a ball player. Where did that come from? Do you have a history with baseball before that?
Yeah, I played it early in my life, and it's really a game that I always felt like I understood, and played it in the street, played it on an organized level, and a lot of people dream about being able to play professional baseball, and you could put me in that same same category, and I've been able to now play it, and I've been able to pitch a perfect game in Yankee Stadium with Vin Scully announcing it, and so it's
right, that was the film for The Love of the Game.
Yeah, it's been a really good ride for where that's been concerned.
Did you do anything in particular for that film to get a feel for the culture of pro ball players? What the dugout, what the clubhouse is like?
No, I did my research, but I've had it, and it is I've seen that thing that was described, athletic arrogance. I've seen it all. So it was not one that was a foreign. I would not, for instance, play a hockey movie. I would let someone else do that because I don't know the nuance of it. I can't skate. But I was very confident about Bull Durham and in this minor league situation about what was happening. And I had this perfect roadmap.
Well, we should talk about Dances with Wolves, which is just looms large in your career. This was a Michael Blake novel adapted for the screen. And I read that, now this was, you directed this film and, of course, won the Oscar for Best Director. It also won Best Picture and five other awards that year. But I read that you actually envisioned someone else directing it, right?
I did. I initially asked two very prominent directors. I won't name them. And both of them saw flaws in the script. I don't think they saw them as, they might have saw them as flaws in the script, but they recognized the conventions of modern day filmmaking. And the first one identified that he felt that that maybe the Civil War sequence, because I told them that the movie was long, and as they looked at it, they immediately thought that maybe we didn't need the opening Civil War sequence. It took up about 15 or 20 minutes where, you know, it established kind of who he was. And I saw, and you could see that that was a natural cut in a film, but I thought, no, I don't want to do that. And then the other one suggested that maybe the Mary McDonald character should be, you know, a Native American woman, that her being a white captive was maybe a bit cliche. And I thought, no, I mean, I can understand why they might think that, but that if you know anything about the American frontier, white captives were, was a way of life. It was a way of commerce. It just is what happened when you had this migratory march across this continent without any kind of military being around. It was, a lot of people think of it in a sense of, about Indians, about movie, about Native Americans. And I take, I'm happy that they think that, but it really was a white man's story who ventured in.
Well, let's hear a cut from Dances with Wolves. This is a moment well into the film where you as Lieutenant Dunbar have settled with this Lakota Sioux tribe, and they are going off to fight a war. You wanted to be involved, but Kicking Bird, who was the one of the men that you've come to deal with, has said, no, you should stay behind. And this scene is translated through the Merritt McDonald character, whose name is Stands With Fist, I think.
Yes.
So let's listen to this cut from Dances with Wolves.
Tiwahi mitawa kile awayanka okihi sechalo.
He also asked that you watch over his family while he is gone. This thing he asks is a great honor for you.
Tell him that I would be happy to watch over his family.
Huh, okihi kea. He thanks Dances with Wolves for coming.
Who's Dances with Wolves?
It is the name which all the people are calling you now.
And that's from Dances with Wolves, directed by our guest Kevin Costner. One of the things that was interesting about this film was that so much of the film is actually in subtitles with the Indian character speaking the Lakota Sioux
right.
language. And
right.
I imagine that might not have been so easy for a studio to digest. Talk a little bit about how you decided to use the Lakota language and, you know, mechanically. I mean, not that many people speak it. You have
right.
to learn some
well,
of it.
Well, as we took the movie around, it was passed on a, you know, we did the whole circuit through town and it was passed on. I was on my second lap and literally at the last studio, and the comment that came back was, Kev, we understand what you're talking about. We understand that you want to make this movie long, but the thing that is bothering us is the subtitles. We're just not sure that it's going to fly. I thought, you know, it's so funny because I think that's what makes the movie is the sense of humor, the sense of kind of what really caused so much conflict on the frontier was our inability to communicate. And that was kind of the, that was kind of the pivot point for me on this movie, that these people who desperately should be talking to each other, want to talk to each other, couldn't. And this simple language allowed fear and everything to slide in. And so I looked at everybody in the meeting. I go, you know, it has to, no, the subtitles have to be there. And at that point, they really couldn't make the movie. And I decided to throw a last chip into the pot, if you will. And I said, by the way, I also want to have final cut on it. I remember as I left the room, my partner, as we shut the door, he pulled me right against the wall, just literally, you know, just outside the door, and goes, what was that about? I said, what was what about? He says, the final cut, what was that about? Why'd you have to throw that in? And I said, well, Jimmy, you know, it just dawned on me that if people don't understand completely about how the movie is, how can we also put somebody in the position of cutting this movie? It was kind of a bold move, but it kind of almost like becoming an actor. A lot of things just became clear.
My guest is Kevin Costner. His new movie is Mr. Brooks. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. If you're just joining me, my guest is actor Kevin Costner. His new film is Mr. Brooks. The story is about Kevin Costner's career. Always talk about, there was the enormous success with Dances with Wolves, and then there's what's called the slump. Waterworld, most expensive film ever made at that time. Mixed reviews, and then Postman, not so good reviews. How do you look at that period? I mean, do you see it as a slump?
Well, I think if you look at things empirically, if you want to look at things empirically and talk about money, then Waterworld certainly paid for itself multiple times. It's very difficult to get anybody to write that, but that was a very financially successful movie, and a movie that's kind of loved around the world. People are almost ashamed to say, I get it all the time. Hey, Kev, by the way, I liked Waterworld. Uh-huh. It was flawed, as are all movies that I've been a part of, and it has its flaws. But I understand kind of what you're asking. I've just always kind of put my stock in the individual movie, and I go forward. I like The Postman, but I can't, sit and try to convince someone else to like it. I liked it. That's why I did it. And I don't like turning my back on my work. And but I certainly should allow other people their opinion about it.
I thought we'd talk about another one of your more recent films, The Upside of Anger, in where you play a retired ball player who lives next door to a woman, Terry, played by Joan Allen, whose husband has apparently taken off with another woman to Sweden. And your character, Denny Davies, the retired ball player,
right,
has kind of develops a drinking relationship. And I wanted to play this clip. This is after the two of you have finally gotten close enough to have intimacy, and this is the immediate aftermath.
Right.
Oh, God. Now, that was a real misstep.
Oh, that was a sweet thing to say.
God, what am I doing? Why am I here?
You're here because you're sad and lonely. Desperate. You need someone, something. Anything to fill you, any port in a storm.
I asked why I was here, not you. What's my story?
Most of us don't look like that. Why would you look like that, all buffed out, look like you just come out of prison or something, we want you to be just like us. And then when you actually, somebody like myself that has played, let's say, traditional leads in American film, comes out with a pot belly, it's amazing how critically people come after that and don't tie that necessarily to a character choice. It's funny, but yeah, I let him be soft. Clearly, he's gone. I mean, he was an athlete that went to the highest level, and he's not doing that now. He's signing autographs at shows for guys that he doesn't want to be around. So I thought that's just a choice.
How did you gain the weight and lose it?
Well, when I want to lose weight, I just quit drinking milk. And because I'm a milk drinker, I mean, I've never done one of those commercials, but that's all I do is drink milk. So when I'm drinking milk, everything that goes with it, apple pie, all this stuff late at night, everything heated, heat Twinkie. I heat Twinkies, man, for crying out loud, just so they just seem really great. And then there goes the milk. So if I want to lose weight, I just quit drinking milk.
All right. Diet tip for those of you out there who want to hear something.
Yeah, it's that scientific.
You recently directed and starred in Open Range, a Western with Robert Duvall. I mean, this is, you've done Westerns a fair amount over your career. I'm thinking back to Silverado, which was, you were very young and a different kind of cowboy.
Right.
What do you love about this genre?
I think it's our Shakespeare, and I think they're, number one, very difficult to make. They're not easy. They're a lot more sophisticated than just yep and nope. And there's the black hat and the white hat, but how you get to those is if you actually really try to understand the time that people were having to live by their wits back then. It's not frontier land like in Disneyland. It's, sometimes the West has become mythical, but it was a very real place 150 years ago where people were living and dying based on decisions, based on going left and right. And I think when you treat the Western that way, you have a chance to make, you know, a movie that can relate to a contemporary audience, but you don't have to kowtow to them by trying to make everything modern. If you just exist in the moment, that's why I say it's Shakespeare. You will begin to understand. I don't completely understand Shakespeare, but when I see it performed beautifully, I suddenly, 10 minutes in, begin to understand everything that's said, every nuance that's there. And the West is the same thing. I think you find the Victorian language that was going on there, that the simplicity of what one man would say to another when he wanted him to get his message. And pretty soon, you don't have to be just an American to understand that what he said was really serious.
Well, Kevin Costner, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Kevin Costner, he stars in the new film, Mr. Brooks. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel. In stores and online at bn.com. From Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the great surf guitarist Dick Dale. His classic recordings are being reissued. Also, the film comedy Music and Lyrics, starring Hugh Grant as a has-been 80s pop star trying to write a new song, is now out on DVD. We'll talk with director Mark Lawrence. Join us for the next Fresh Air.